Good to be with you, brethren, this afternoon, and I've enjoyed the sessions with Brother Wade and Brother Mike so far, and now we're ready to look at the book of Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes is one of the books of wisdom, and I think we all agree that it's written by Solomon, although not everybody is of that opinion. When you look at commentators, you see the different views they have of this book, and some of them are real happy with the book, and others you get a different impression. But I like this book a great deal. I get a lot of edification from it, and I'm sure those of you that have studied this have gotten the same edification. In 1 Kings chapter 10, I like this description of Solomon. And as we said, I assume most of us here would agree it was written by Solomon. The literal description of it in verse 1, he's the son of David, king in Jerusalem. And he says that again down in verse 12. I, the preacher, was king over Israel in Jerusalem. And there was only one son of David that was king in Jerusalem, that is the literal son. That would be King Solomon. 1 Kings chapter 10 is a description of Solomon. And I think we can apply this to this book here. 1 Kings chapter 10 is where we read about the Queen of Sheba coming to visit Solomon. And would someone like to read verses 1 through 10 of 2 Kings? Or 1 Kings 10. You'll also find this in 2 Chronicles, the 9th chapter. 1 Kings 10, 1 through 10. Okay, thanks, Thomas. Here is just one example of how great Solomon was, and it's good for us to have a great respect for Solomon when we listen to what he writes. Can you imagine how impressed the Queen of Sheba is with King Solomon? And she says to him, the half was not told. They told me how great you were, but they didn't tell me half of it. And so I like verse 8 especially. Happy are your men. Happy are these your servants. What's the word happy mean? What did you take it? Joyful. It can mean that, yeah. Yeah, blessed. It has to do with position. It has to do with where they're at. Your servants and the people who get to hear you are in a good position. They are fortunate. They are happy. So that, of course, if you realize that you're in a good position, that will cause you to be joyful. If you don't realize your position, then you're not. And I think that the Queen of Sheba saw how great Solomon was in his wisdom, and so we ought to also recognize how important his wisdom is. Where did his wisdom come from? Yeah, it came from God. It goes along with what Wade was saying about our talents and our abilities. It all came from God. Solomon used what God gave him. God gave him more. You keep using what God gives you, God keeps giving you more. So, the Queen of Sheba gave him a lot, didn't she? What do you want to give to King Solomon? Anybody want to give Solomon anything? An ear, that's right. Let's give him our ear, because we will be happy too. We will be blessed like his servants if we give him our ears. Solomon, in this book, about the only reason I could find that anybody disputed this with Solomon was they said that they didn't think Solomon ever repented of his idolatry. Therefore, he never would have written a book like this. Well, I would rather think that Solomon did repent of his idolatry, and that when he realized that he would lose 10 tribes, that it caused remorse. I would rather not think that he was beyond repentance, and that upon realizing what he'd done, he was sorry. But if it is as I think, and as others think, that this is Solomon's repentance, then it's probably towards the end of his life. And that's one reason in chapter 12, he can speak pretty well about being old, can't he? That description there's just really does fit what happens to us when we get old. And I appreciated Mike's point in his class today. If you were looking for a key sentence or thought in this first chapter, which one would you pick out? And there are several that might come to mind at first, but which one do you think might be the best one that would fit the whole book? Okay. Vanity of Vanities does, it fits pretty well. It's definitely one of the strong points of the book. Yeah. Okay. 16, 17, good. That's good. Yeah. The one I landed on was 13, the one Josh said. I, the preacher, was king over Israel and Jerusalem, verse 12, and I gave my heart to seek and search out by wisdom concerning all things that are done under heaven. This sore travail hath God given to the sons of man to be exercised therewith. He's going to engage in something that other people have done. In fact, you could almost say that almost everybody does this. Everybody, in some sense, tries to find out, how should I live life? And the decision that a lot of us come to or fall into is usually, at least for a while, I'll live life the way I think best. Now, what's different between Solomon and the rest of us? When it comes to this question of how am I going to live my life, how is Solomon different from us? Resources, that's exactly right. So Solomon's in a position to really try it out. You know, I could decide, well, I think I should do what I feel like is best. But I'm limited, aren't I? You know, maybe taking a trip to Europe would really make you happy. Ah, but I don't have the money for that. You know, I'm limited in my resources, and King Solomon is not really limited. As he says over in chapter 2 and verse 10, whatever my eyes desired, I kept not from them. I withheld not my heart from any joy, for my heart rejoiced in all my labor, and this was my portion of all my labor. So he speaks there as though he could get anything he wanted. And that's the limitation most everybody else has, is we just couldn't do everything even if we wanted to. Solomon's going to try to do everything. And basically, I believe Solomon does everything. And that's why his conclusion is going to be so impressive, is after trying everything, he's going to come to the conclusion, as we all know from this last chapter, that we need to fear God and keep His commandments. We need to serve the Lord, give our best to the Master. Those are things we've heard from childhood up, but we can be like Solomon too and think, well, yeah, but what would it be like if I went out and tried this? What if I did this? Maybe that would make me happy. Maybe I'd find some pleasure there if I'd go out and do that. Solomon is setting his mind to doing something that most everybody wants to do and most everybody does to a certain extent. I believe that Solomon is repentant like his father. His father David was repentant in Psalm 51. Remember one of the things David wanted to do after when he was praying to God and repenting? He said in Psalm 51:10-13, he said, if you'll renew a right spirit in me and restore the joy of your salvation, then I'll teach transgressors your ways. So that was David's kind of repentance, and it seems like that's the kind of repentance Solomon is showing here too. I'll teach transgressors your ways. Try to help them so they don't make the same mistakes that I made. Okay, so Richard mentioned verse 2, and this certainly is one of the themes throughout the book, but it's especially emphasized here in chapter 1. What does it mean, vanity of vanities? Or some other words you've got for vanity. Yeah, meaningless, meaningless. Anybody looked up the word? Empty, okay. Does it come from another word? I'm thinking it's in that other word that there's a connection here. Futility. That's a good word. Futility. Well, anyway, you can compare it to what James says about life. What did James say your life is? It's a vapor. And there's a picture of futility, isn't it? A picture of meaninglessness. What did that mean? I saw that vapor there for a minute, and now it's gone. Well, what was that? And so life can appear to be that way as well. Just the vanity of vanities. Just so meaningless. What profit has a man of all his labor which he taketh under the sun? So vanity of vanities is a phrase that you'll remember from Ecclesiastes. And also remember this phrase, under the sun. Because I think that's a key to understanding a lot of this. He's talking about how life looks under the sun. What is life like here on earth? Well, if this is all there is, it sure looks kind of meaningless. It's kind of pointless. And you can take that along with the idea. I've heard people question this book. Because over in chapter 3 and verse 21, he puts this in question form. Who knows the spirit of man that goes upward and the spirit of the beast that goes down to the earth? And he just talked about how everybody goes the same place, the animals and people. They all die. They all go into the ground. Who knows the spirit of man that goes upward and the spirit of the beast that goes down into the earth? Now, do you think the writer of this knows the answer to his question? Okay, how do we know he knows the answer to the question? You're right, he does know the answer. And we know that because he says the answer in chapter 12 and verse 7. There it is not put in question form. It is the truth. Then shall the dust return to the earth as it was, and the spirit shall return unto God who gave it. And so they understood that man has a spirit that will go back to God, even though the body goes to the same place that animals' bodies go to. But just because our bodies go to the same place does not mean we are the same as animals. Does anybody else think that the society is looking at men and animals the same way nowadays? It's all around us, isn't it? So that's why this question is good. Who knows? The spirit that goes up and the spirit that goes down. Spirit goes up is ours. Spirit goes down is the animals. We're hearing preachers talk about animals going to heaven. They need to ask that question again, don't they? Wait a minute. Where does the spirit of the animal go? It doesn't go back to God. It goes down. It's for here. It's for under the sun. And the spirit of man is what goes back to God. So remember that phrase, under the sun. That's how Solomon's looking at life. If you just look at life as it is under the sun, it's pretty meaningless. Things are going round and round, round and round. One songwriter writes how he sits and watches the wheels turning. I just sit here and watch the wheels turning. Wow. What a guy. But that's the way life looks. Like, it's just wheels turning around and around under the sun. But we understand that there's more to life. There's a meaning behind all this. There is an eternal purpose that God has created us for. Well, what profit do you get out of all your labor which you take under the sun? Can you think of a way this could apply to Solomon? What kind of an event in his life would make him wonder about what profit do you get from all your labor under the sun? Anything happen to Solomon that might make him wonder these things? You could tie into him losing his kingdom. And you can take that along with chapter 2 and verse 18 and 19. 18 through 20. I'm going to read that for us, Richard. 18 through 20, chapter 2.
Then I hated all my labor and which I had toiled under the sun, because I must leave it to the man who will come after me. And who knows whether he will be wise or a fool? Yet he will rule over all my labor and which I toiled and in which I have shown myself wise in the sun. This also is vanity. Therefore, I turn my heart and despair of all the labor in which I have toiled under the sun.
Very good. This is kind of a sad picture, isn't it, if you apply that Solomon and his son. Kind of sad, isn't it? To think of how wise Solomon was, and you'd think that Rehoboam could have made, you know, a wise decision, but he was going to lose the kingdom, and he listened to his peers and wouldn't listen to He wouldn't listen to years. He listened to his peers. And he lost the kingdom. Solomon asked, you know, who am I going to leave all this to? I don't know if he's going to be wise or not. I just don't know what he's going to be like. And he goes through these next verses in the first chapter describing how all these things, you got one generation passing away, another one comes. But the earth just seems to abide forever. Remember, that's the way the skeptics will make fun of us. They'll say all things continue as they were from the beginning of creation. And so there's this idea, without faith, that the earth will just continue on. It's always going to be here. But that's not what God says. Sun goes up, sun goes down. Sun goes up, sun goes down. It's monotonous. It's boring. The wind goes towards the south, goes to the north, whirls around continually, returns again according to his circuits. All the rivers run into the sea, yet the sea is not full. And to the place from whence the rivers come, there they return again. Solomon's getting kind of scientific here, isn't he? For these are scientific truths. But he's describing cycles. How come everything just keeps going around? What's the point? Why do things just keep going around? All things are full of labor. Man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. Have you ever thought about how everything's working all the time? Thought about how your body's working all the time? Your body's working right now. Working, working, and we aren't even aware of a lot of the processes that are going on. You just keep working. What's it doing this week? What's all this for? And that phrase is really important to remember. The eye is not satisfied with seeing or the ear filled with hearing. Remember, that's the point, that's the problem with following the flesh. You follow the flesh and you will will never find satisfaction because the eye's never satisfied with seeing. If I could just see it, well, then you'll want to see something else. Then you want to see something different. Well, if I could just hear it, well, then you'll want to hear something else. So the flesh, always remember, will never satisfy us because it's not made to be satisfied. It's made to keep wanting more, 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 more. What was it Solomon said back here in Proverbs 30, verse 15, 16? The horse leech has two daughters crying, give, give. There are three things that are never satisfied, yea, four things never, say not, it is enough. The grave, the barren womb, the earth that is not filled with water, and the fire that saith not, it is enough. And isn't it interesting how the world is always encouraging us to turn it loose and let yourself go and don't hold back, just encouraging the flesh to be unleashed. Well, what's the flesh going to get when it's unleashed? It won't get satisfaction. So Solomon's saying, all these things under the sun, and you want to see them? Well, okay, you can see them, but you're not going to be happy. You want to hear them? You're not going to be happy. How many songs can you get on your iPod? Can you get enough songs to get happy? Now, I've got 500 songs. Now I'm going to be happy. The ear is not satisfied. It's not filled with hearing. I'm going to have to keep listening to it. I'm tired of that. I want to listen to something different. See, there's no satisfaction here. So Solomon's saying it's meaningless. If these things here on earth don't satisfy you, what's the point? And verse 9 and 10, of course, is the ones that we often think about and quote. The thing which has been, it is that which shall be. That which is done is that which shall be done. There is no new thing under the sun. Is there anything whereof it may be said, see, this is new. It has been already of old time which was before us. And of course, in our day and age, with all of our great technological advances, we think that, oh, we got a lot of new things. We got a lot of things Solomon didn't have. But in principle and in essence, do we have anything new? What was Solomon's iPod? Yeah. Solomon had live entertainment. And that's better than our technology. As far as listening to music, listening to songs, he had live entertainment. He could afford it. He had it really good when it came to entertainment. But no, in principle, I think is the idea, no matter what people come up with, it's not really something completely new. Always based on something else. Always based on something that's already been. It's kind of like some of our technology is based on God's creation, like flying. And then looked at how God designed birds, and they were able to come up with flying machines. So even in that respect, there's our new airplanes are based upon things that God has already put in creation. And it's, none of these new things have made anybody happy, have they? They haven't satisfied our soul. And so Solomon says, I'm going to see what's good for man. What is the right way for man to live? What is the chief good of man? And kind of like, in principle, again, nothing is new. This is really similar, I think, to how Satan tempted Eve. This tree of knowledge of good and evil, it will make you as wise as God. You'll know good and evil. And isn't this the way many people live today? they are their own God. I determine my own truth. If I think it's right for me, if it's good for me, that's what I do. So this is still the same spirit that lives in the world today. Still the same spirit we're tempted with. We can live that way ourselves. And think that because we go to church that we're still pleasing God. But we can go to church and still have this attitude of, I will live life my way. So Solomon is going to set out, and as Grant said, he's got the resources to do it. He talks here in verse 14 about how all is vanity and vexation of spirit. He sees everything that's done, it's all vanity and vexation of spirit. That which is crooked cannot be made straight. That which is wanting cannot be numbered. You think Solomon might have been thinking about politics when he was thinking about that? How about if we fix politics? Wouldn't that be nice? We could fix the political machine, make it honest. We could get rid of all special interests. I guess we'd have to get rid of people. You're a special interest, not me. The crooked cannot be made straight. We try our best, but why is it we can't fix this? That which is wanting cannot be numbered. We can't fix it. So Solomon says, I gave my heart to wisdom. I've gotten more wisdom than all they that have been before me in Jerusalem. And I gave my heart to know wisdom, in verse 17, to know madness and folly. I perceive that this also is vexation of spirit, for in much wisdom is much grief. And he that increases knowledge increases sorrow. Did you ever feel like you knew too much? You wish you hadn't learned that certain thing. I'm not talking about knowing it all, but I'm talking about, I wish I didn't know that. He that increases knowledge increases sorrow. And yet it's very tempting to think, if I just knew more, then I'd be happy. If I could just know more things, that would make me happy. There are people in the world today who still believe this very strongly. They believe they can solve the world's problems just through more knowledge. We just know a little bit more. We just discover ourselves and figure ourselves out a little better. We'll have the answer to our problems. Socialism has this hope that if man just works together and shares everything, one day we'll all be nice to each other. We'll all share. We won't have mean, rich people. We'll all be good to each other. But it's a false hope, isn't it? There's nothing in our past to base that hope upon. We don't naturally go that direction. Only with God's help do we go in a godly manner and live the way the Lord wants us to. So Solomon realizes the limitations of wisdom, knowledge. Madness and folly. That's interesting. What do you think he meant was talking about when he wanted to know madness and folly? Does madness and folly appeal to you? Yeah, it does. It does. Okay. You remember saying that, no? No, I don't fully understand all that Solomon was, or what Solomon was thinking exactly when he said that. But I know that madness and folly is appealing sometimes. In madness and folly, there is often humor, and that can be appealing. I was thinking of a skit a Monty Python skit, the Ministry of Silly Walks. Well, that's an example of madness and folly, but it's funny because it points to that which is crooked cannot be made straight. Now, how if we think government will solve problems, we'll come up with departments of silly walks. And if you think you've got a silly walk that needs a grant to support it, well, maybe we can give you a grant. But it's the kind of madness and folly that just kind of eases the pain of how life is here on earth. This is the way people are. But Solomon found out that didn't make him happy either. Provided some pleasure, but wasn't really satisfying. So in chapter 2, this is where Solomon, in Ecclesiastes 2, this is where he leaves the library, so to speak, and goes to prove himself with mirth and pleasure. I will prove thee with mirth and pleasure. And here's where he definitely gets into the humor side of life. Let's just laugh. Let's just have a good time. Let's laugh about life. This also is meaningless. I said of laughter, it is mad. And of mirth, what does it? What's it doing? I sought in my heart to give myself into wine, yet acquainting mine heart with wisdom. Wasn't going to let himself go completely, but he did want to find out what the thing was with wine. And to lay hold on folly, till I might see what was that good for the sons of men which they should do under the heaven all the days of their life. And you could combine verse 3 with verse 13 of chapter 1. That's what Solomon's trying to do. He's trying to see, hey Dan, trying to see the best way for man to live while he's here. Well, you pursue wisdom and you'll soon find its limits. You pursue madness and folly, mirth, laughter, wine. You're going to see their limitations, that they're not giving you a meaning for life. We weren't put here to laugh. That's not our ultimate good in life. Well, I'm laughing. I'm accomplishing my purpose. Well, you're not quite there yet. And verse 4, let's get busy. I made me great works. I built houses. I planted vineyards. Makes you wonder what Solomon would have thought of Home Depot and Lowe's and places like that. You do a lot of building. You can make a lot of things. Maybe that'll make you happy. Maybe that's what the meaning of life is. It's just being able to build things. Well, building things has its place, but it's not the ultimate good. It's not the chief aim of life. I made gardens and orchards. I planted trees in them of all kinds of fruits. Sounds pretty good, doesn't it? I made pools of water. Water where therewith the wood that brings forth trees. He's got a lot of help for this. Servants and maidens, servants born in his house. He also had great possessions of great and small cattle above all that were in Jerusalem before me. I gathered me also silver and gold and the peculiar treasures of kings and of the provinces. I got me men singers and women singers and the delights of the sons of men as musical instruments and that of all sorts. He really does have it made, doesn't he? He's got everything. And yet he still has been saying it's all vanity. It's all meaningless. He was a great man. I was great and increased more than all that were before me in Jerusalem. And also my wisdom remained with me. That in itself is a blessing, isn't it? Some men get mad. They lose their sense. But Solomon kept his wisdom. I think that's probably why he was able to repent. He was still able to see right and wrong, and he could turn around before it was eternally too late. And we already looked at verse 10, but remember, this is how powerful Solomon was as far as getting what he wanted. Whatever my eyes desired, I kept not from them. Can you see how that fits into the lust of the eye? The lust of the eye. What if you could get everything your eye saw? Anything you saw, you could get it. Solomon could. And his conclusion is, it's meaningless. It's all meaningless. It's a vexation of the spirit. It never made me happy. I got all these things and I wasn't happy. Verse 11, then I looked on all the works that my hands had wrought, and on the labor that I'd labored to do. Behold, all was vanity and vexation of spirit, and there was no profit under the sun. And again, there's that phrase, under the sun. As far as under the sun, there really was no profit. For one thing, who's going to get this when I'm gone? I'm not going to be here forever. Who's going to get it? How did this help me to get this? I only get it for a little bit. Now it's going to be gone. John? I take under the sun to mean the things that we see in this earth life. In other words, looking at life without God in the picture. That's what I take. How do you take it? No, I agree. I agree with your definition. That the idea here is Solomon's approaching it, I think, from the idea that, okay, if we just look at life without God in the picture, where's the profit? What's the good in it? No, I agree with that. And it's another way of teaching us to put the Lord first, too. If we put the Lord first, that puts earthly things in perspective. And then we can enjoy them in the right way. And you can enjoy them and not be attached to them, which is nice. That's what makes it hard for people who don't have God, is that it's easier for them to become attached to these things, and therefore when they lose them, it's a tragedy. But for us, if we lose any of these earthly pleasures, it's not a tragedy, because that's not where our happiness was put. Yeah, thanks for clarifying that, John. I appreciate it. So Solomon's saying that I'm looking at everything that I've done, and I just, it's vanity, it's meaningless, it's vexation of spirit. And that question, verse 12, is really good. I turn myself to behold wisdom and madness and folly, for what can the man do that comes after the king? Even that which has been already done. So we can ask ourselves, can I do something that Solomon could not do? Would it be worth my time to set out on a similar venture? I think I'll see if it's good to live your life pursuing all these pleasures. I'll set out and see if I can, and I'll come back with a report on how that turned out. Well, I think Solomon's telling us here, can you really do anything different than what I've done? And I don't think we can. We'll just try the same things he tried. We might have other drugs than wine, but they're still drugs. They're still mind-altering substances. We might have other ways to make ourselves laugh. We'll have more knowledge, possibly, and very likely more knowledge than what Solomon had access to. But are we really doing anything differently than what Solomon did? And this has really helped. I think that what Solomon is doing here, he's just doing it in a different way, but he is affirming a lot of the things that are taught in other places in the Bible. We already alluded to James chapter 4, where James said that your life is a vapor that appears for a little while and then vanishes away. Solomon, I think, is saying the same thing. Our life is like a vapor. And without God in the picture, there's no point. There's no point. I think you can tie it into what Wade was talking about, too, when you talk about serving the Lord. When you live this life here on earth, if you do these things as unto the Lord, then there's definite profit in them, isn't there? Definite meaning to life when you're doing them for the Lord. When the husband loves his wife, even as Christ loved the church, when the wife submits to her husband as Christ submitted to his Father and as the church submits to Christ, that's very profitable because that's making us more godly. That's exercise unto godliness. Remember, Solomon uses this word exercise. We just saw that back in verse 13 of chapter 1. Our exercise is not to see if maybe I could satisfy the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eye, and the pride of life. That's not our exercise. The exercise that is good is godly exercise. Exercise unto godliness. So when you pursue earthly things, which we all must, pursue them as unto the Lord, and then you and I will become more like the Lord in those pursuits. This is a very good approach that Solomon is taking. Does anyone have any modern examples of anyone who's tried things like Solomon? Maybe some modern rich people? Pretty good. Good example, Tom. For a mere $20 million, you can exceed Solomon and leave the atmosphere going to outer space. Good point. Now see, that would be something that would be kind of fun to do that, wouldn't it? If you were inclined that way. But I think probably all of us here would not look at that as the meaning, the definition of our life. We'd just say, that'd be kind of neat to do that. But we wouldn't think, if I could only do that, then life would have meaning. And that's the difference. We don't look at any earthly physical accomplishment as though that will define our being. We look to God for the definition of our being. We look to Christ. That's a good example, huh? Do you remember that story about Bob Dylan? When he got into money, I heard one time he got into money, and I think he got the advice of some of the Beatles. But anyway, they told him, they said, you should buy yourself a big mansion and buy a lot of stuff. You know, buy stuff you've always wanted to buy and put them in your mansion. And so he said he did that and sat down in the middle of all that and just felt nothing. He got it all, but still wasn't doing it for him. And there are others that you will probably read about if you haven't before or hear about that will try the same things. They will think that when you get the resources, that means follow your desires. But you can follow your desires, but that's not going to lead you to your purpose in life. Solomon is making these mistakes for our benefit, although I don't think you necessarily intended to, but they do benefit us, don't they? They've helped me a lot. Kind of put a damper on any desires I've had to do things like this, knowing that here's somebody that has tried it, and they sure aren't recommending it. So I'm thankful to Solomon for that. If you have any other comments or thoughts on these first two chapters, we didn't look at everything in them, but I think I've tried to go over the gist of what's going on here in the first two chapters. Any other things you want to bring up? We didn't talk specifically about the burdens and tasks, but we did look at verse 13 as kind of the key verse of this passage and of the whole book. What do you have to say about that, Dan? Here's the way I take it, Dan. I take it that Solomon is saying the burdensome task that God's given to us is to figure out what life is. That's the way I take that. Rather than pursuing riches or anything that Solomon did, I think he's just saying, what is the reason that we're here? That in itself is a task, to figure that out. To finally come to the conclusion that serving God is the best way to live, that's not necessarily an easy conclusion to come to. It's easy to say it, but to really believe it can be a hard thing to come to. And that's how I take that. And everybody's with that task. And if we follow the flesh, we probably don't want to come to that conclusion that God should be first. If we follow the flesh, it would be, we'll probably do what Solomon did. We'll say, well, I think I ought to be doing this, I'll be doing that. And we'll miss our reason for living. So that's our exercise, I think, is to find out why we're here and to come to the conclusion that we're here to seek God. And if I seek God, I've found my purpose. And I will find my Creator in following that purpose. I think it is. Yeah, I think it is. Now, the yoke of Christ is not a burden. That's true. But to find it, to get to it, it's a task. Good question. Good. Any other comments on the burdensome task? Because that is what this book is about, is why are we here? And am I really convinced that I'm here for God? Or do I still have some, you know, doubts in my mind? Maybe there's some other things that. Okay. Well, I'm going to pick out some of my favorite parts here, and as we go along, if you find one that you like, feel free to bring it up. Chapter 3, these first 8 verses, these verses were made popular back in the 60s by a popular song, so influential that some people think "turn, turn, turn" is in this passage, but it's not. That was their addition to it, but pretty much they quoted almost everything in this passage. But it is a great passage. It's talking about life, and one of the beautiful things about the passage is it's so simple. It's almost like it's stating obvious things, and yet it's good to have them stated. That is the duty of leaders, is to restate the obvious. And here we definitely have the obvious restated for us, but yet it's a great comforting thing. One sister in the church who's gone from us now, but she passed away a few years ago, but she told me one time that when she lost her husband, and at that time she'd been a widow for a good 20 years, it might have been more like 30 years. So she'd been alone a long time, and she said this was about her favorite passage in the whole Bible. And that really made me look at the passage again to see what is it about this passage that would be so comforting to someone in her situation. And it's just a part of what's comforting is that God is reassuring us that life changes. There are different times in life. And I can't, I'm not being reasonable if I want life to be the same all the time. Well, I always want it to be this way. But life changes. And you have to be ready for the different times of life. There's the time to be born and the time to die. Those are pretty different, aren't they? Just think how different the time you're born will be from the time you die. If you can picture in your mind the time you die, it's all speculation, of course, but those will be two completely different times. But that's life. Life is not always the same. Richard? Good. Good deal. Very good point, Richard. Whatever time or season of life you find yourself in, you should be able to find it beautiful. See the purpose and beauty of it. Very good. And speaking of the time to be born and the time to die, which one did Solomon say is better? Yeah. The day of one's death and the day of one's birth, chapter 7 and verse 1. Now, why would the day of your death be better than the day of your birth? Very good. That's one reason. And chapter 7 is a time of reflection and sobriety. It'll be better for other people in that respect. Yeah. That's good. The burdensome task is over. Good point, Wade. Which is better? 8 o'clock in the morning or 5 o'clock in the evening? Yeah, if you're working, it's 5 o'clock in the evening, isn't it? Whew, done. You can go home now. But under the sun, that's not the perspective most people have. Under the sun, the big deal is your birthday, which is just kind of vanity and vexation anyway, isn't it? How many people like the birthdays? Little kids usually do. But that usually sets them up for a lot of disappointment too, doesn't it? And then when people get older, they start dreading birthdays. But under the sun, the birthday was made to be the big deal, you know. The day you're born, that's the big thing. And it's only when you live a lot longer than anybody else, do you become interested in your birthday again, so. Or at least are willing to talk about it. But this is it's a beautiful list here. The time to plan and the time to pluck up that which is planned. It's two different times. And yet they're related, aren't they? They're all a part of life. Remind me of the brother in the church, he loved to put out the garden. But once it was planted, he didn't want any more to do with it. So others who were willing to pluck up that which was planted had to step in. But he was always glad to plant. But for some reason, he didn't like the harvesting part. Two different parts of life. Time to kill and a time to heal. Time to break down, time to build up. How true. If you're careful about what you build, it'll save on time breaking down. Time to weep and a time to laugh. So even if you want to laugh all the time, that's not life. There's also a time to weep. A time to love and a time to hate. So when is the time to hate? And verse 8, when's the time to hate? Okay, good. You hate the things that are evil. That's definitely a time to hate. Abhor that which is evil. Cleave to that which is evil. What do you think David meant when he said that he hated his enemies and the enemies of God with a perfect hatred? A perfect hatred. There's perfect love and there's perfect hatred. Let's go to our sages in the group for the answer. What do you think David meant when he said, I hate them with a perfect hatred? That's definitely a time to hate. Assuming that he's right in what he's saying. Verse 21 of Psalm 139. Do not I hate them, O Lord, that hate thee? And am I not grieved with those that rise up against thee? I hate them with perfect hatred. I count them mine enemies. Search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me and know my thoughts. See if there be any wicked way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting. What do you think, John? What do you think the perfect hatred is here? Good. I agree. Yeah, good. Matthew 5, John brings up Matthew 5 where Jesus says to love your enemies. And if you only love those that do good to you, you're not doing anything more than the tax collector. So be perfect like your Father in heaven is perfect. He loves everybody. Yeah, and that's good, a good one to try to harmonize. God loves everybody in the sense of sending his rain on good people and on bad people. He blesses everybody. He gives everybody the opportunity to come to him. That's love. But this hatred probably goes more along with what John was saying, that as far as your feelings of pleasure and goodwill, that's different than the kind of perfect love, I think, that he's talking about. See, when you love somebody in that respect, in Matthew 5, that simply means you care what happens to them. But the best kind of love is not just that love out of duty, but it's also the kind of love where you actually enjoy them. You have pleasure in them. That's why you have friends. Your friends, not only do you care about them, but you actually like them. You like being with them. And that's kind of the difference I would make here. When somebody is an enemy of God, it's hard, and we shouldn't feel good towards them. We shouldn't feel like, oh, I really like being with you. No, there should be a type of a revulsion because of what they stand for and what they do. So I guess on the basic level of God's love is that whether it's an enemy or not, there is an opportunity for them to serve God. But that doesn't mean he has pleasure in it. Going along with what John said about anger, you know, John chapter 3 says, the wrath of God abides on everyone who doesn't believe. God's angry with everyone who doesn't believe him. That doesn't mean he doesn't love them. But it does mean that they are not in his good graces. They've still got enough grace, though, to be saved. They've got God's favor to be saved. Yeah, I appreciate that, John. That's very helpful. And I wanted us to think about that, because that's an interesting thing. The thing about life is there's a time to love and there's a time to hate. But when's the time to hate? Well, at least we know we are to hate evil. We are not to countenance it. And we really have to be careful about that, because the world's been good about fooling us, at least some of us. One of the ways the world gets us to get over our hatred of evil things is to, first of all, make us forget that there are things we are supposed to hate. Oh, you're a Christian. You're supposed to love everything. You're supposed to love everybody. And that's a clever tactic. Another tactic is to get you to laugh at evil. How many times have we laughed at homosexuality? Because it's always out there. Always opportunities to laugh about it. You don't have to accept it. You don't have to agree with it. But don't you think it's kind of funny? Isn't that guy kind of funny, you know? And so once you laugh at it, it kind of takes away the hatred, doesn't it? Well, that's not so bad. It's kind of a light thing. Whenever you laugh at something, it's a light thing. So there is a time to love and there's a time to hate. There's a time for peace and there is a time for war. Well, I wish we didn't have to have that war part, don't you? Couldn't it just always be peace? Let's take a vote. How about always having peace? But it doesn't work, does it? There's a time for war, there's a time for peace. This is life. I think there's a lot to that, that one of the reasons for the changes is that it helps us appreciate the other. That's good. Marvelous. God's wisdom is so good. I tend to think it's how it is. It's just how it is. So how you take it? Yeah, that's. I see what you're saying. I think that. Well, as I was thinking about what Richard said too, I was thinking that there is some of this here we can't completely figure out. The conclusion I come to in my mind is that here's the way life is, so this will help you get through it, to know that it's going to change, it's going to be different. And I think you can get appreciation from it. I think you can. But whatever the reason is for God making it the way this is here, this is a part of life, and this is what we have to go through. In a way, this could also tie into the first chapter, where he's talking about the things that, you know, all the water goes down and goes back, and the sun goes up, the sun goes down. It could tie into that too, and this point's still the same. What's the point of all this? Why are we born? Why do we die? Why do we build things up and tear them down? Why do we sew things together and then tear them apart? Why do we do this? And again, the point is that without God in the picture, it's a pretty futile picture. Very good. I like it when you philosophize. Good. That's what God wants us to do. He wants us to think, and that's good. Solomon's making us all think. We've already talked about verse 21, and I hope that you see that similar to how I do, that the writer here is not asking a question because he doesn't know the answer, but it is more like a rhetorical question. asking it for our benefit. Do you think about your spirit that's going back to God, and that you're different than the animals? The person looking under the sun just says, well, animals die, we die. What's the difference? Are you remembering you have a spirit who goes back to God, and the spirit of that animal goes back to the earth? That's it. It's a temporary spirit. Anything else in chapter 3 you wanted to comment on? Yes. Yep. That's a good point, Richard, that there are one of the reasons some are not sure about Ecclesiastes, because if you do take verses out of context and or just look at one verse at a time, it does sound like, wait a minute, that's not right. That's not really true. But he's speaking, I think Solomon is speaking to people. He's speaking to people who are trying to find out what life is like and what the meaning of life is. And I like that approach. It's not as though he's speaking to everybody who agrees with him. Well, we all know why we're here, don't we? Okay, good. No argument. I think he's speaking to people that would say, well, I just don't understand, you know, what's life about? Why are we here? And I think that the way he's speaking, the way he's writing, will help somebody get from there to faith in God. So I think Richard's point is important to keep in mind, that some of the statements we read in Ecclesiastes, if you take them by themselves, they do sound kind of questionable. Like, I don't know if that's really right or not. Why would that be in the Bible? But you have to keep it in context about how he's writing. John, go ahead. Good point. Yeah, I thought about that with Sodom. Sodom was that was an interesting case, because I was also interested to see how the media would report it too, you know. Did any of them feel any, you know, hatred or any, you know, were they as mad at Sodom as they are at some people who are good? I was interested in their response. But this is something that, and next on Tuesday, Lord willing, those of you that will still be here, when we talk about Nehemiah, this is one of the things that comes up in Nehemiah, is that the way Nehemiah dealt with those people, it is different than what we're used to. And people would look at that and say, well, that's not very Christ-like. And yet it was, Nehemiah is a man of God, and he's doing God's work. And as far as we can tell, his work is approved of by God. So that kind of goes along with what you're saying. But the way we look at sin, sometimes even those who say they're Christians may have the wrong view of how we should look at things. We forget this idea of abhorring what's evil. And it gets clouded over by the love of God. The love of God becomes, rather than God's intentional concern for mankind, the love of God becomes something more like a drug-induced state of euphoria. Just feel good about everything. Feel nice about everybody. But that's not exactly it. Appreciate your comments. Very good. Well, let's look at chapter 4. And the passage I picked out, and like I said, if you like something else in the chapter, feel free to bring it out. I want us to notice in this chapter, verses 9 through 12. That's probably one of your favorite passages, too. Let's see. Josh, you want to read 9 through 12 for us, please? We're all going along with John Lee's question, do you think this is a description of the way things are or the way things ought to be? Maybe there's more than one answer. Yeah, verse 8 does go on. You mentioned it too, Josh. Certainly is a truth that applies in life, and it certainly applies spiritually. Two are better than one because they have a good reward for their labor. This is a really, really cool truth, isn't it? One person has something good. You think, oh, well, they're going to enjoy that. It's interesting, though, how if two people have that same thing, it's even better. Because what happens is, it's like by having somebody else involved, you don't lose anything. You actually get more. And I guess that kind of goes against logic at first. It's like, oh, but I'm going to have to share this joy. But we really don't. We actually multiply the joy. More people get the joy when more are involved. Two are better than one. I always think of a wedding. You think in a wedding, well, it's just the couple that's getting married. They're the only ones benefiting from that. But it's not true, is it? It's everybody they invite. You know, most everybody they invite. They all get that joy too, don't they? The joy gets spread around and multiplied. And it's like the people who are in the wedding and the people that are there to watch it. It's like, it's almost like they're getting the same joy the couple's getting. It's just a wonderful thing. And of course, it all depends on who the couple is. It depends on how close you are to them. But if it's a good couple, it's two people you really think a lot of and you're really happy for them, it's like, well, they're making me happy. You know? And you're not even the one getting married. It's a great principle of life that if you share what you've got, you share the reward, you're not going to lose anything. It's really neat how that works. And if you fall. See, if you could go through life and never fall, this wouldn't be quite so important, would it? Oh, I'm never going to fall. I'm going to be healthy. I'm going to be strong. I don't have to worry about anybody else. Well, we don't know that. We don't have a guarantee. What if you do fall? Who's going to help you get up? Well, if two people are together and one of them falls, the other one will lift up his fellow. Woe to him that's alone when he falls, for he doesn't have another to help him up. And then two people lying together can keep each other warm. I'll keep myself warm. Good luck. Isn't it amazing how two people can keep each other warm, but it's hard to keep yourself warm. And if one prevail against him, two shall withstand him, and a threefold cord is not quickly broken. The threefold cord, of course, makes us think of Christ, gives us a spiritual application. You and me and the Lord. And when you think, apply this to marriage, you and your wife and the Lord. That's not going to be easily broken, is it? How can it? If you're all three bound together. Now, if one of you gets out of it, that's a different story. But if you're all three bound together, that's not going to be easily broken. Richard. It does apply both places, and that's a good scripture to take along with James 5:19-20. Good. Yeah, I like that. You do two things. You save him and you cover a multitude of sins. Okay. I agree, Thomas. That's a good point. I've always felt a little uneasy with the weakest link thing too, because I thought, oh no. I don't know if any congregation is okay. But this analogy is much better. Put everybody together and wrap them together. Wrap them together like the rope and cable. Have you guys ever been to the Golden Gate Bridge? They may do it at other bridges too, but they'll show you a cross section of that cable. And that great big cable that's holding up the thing is just made out of a lot of little wires. But you bind them all together. And bind them together with love. And that's strong enough to hold that bridge up. Pretty good. Yeah, I'm with you, Thomas. I like this analogy better. Let's be wrapped together, and we all help each other. Because even a strong link can break. You know, just because it was strong doesn't mean it can't break. But here we can all help each other. Very good. Any other comments in chapter 4? Good question. Josh brings up the point, what about 1 Corinthians 7, where Paul is saying that it's better for if a man or a woman can remain in life. And I think, like whenever we talk about that passage, it's good to keep that phrase, for the present distress, under consideration. For the present distress. He seems to have that in mind here. He's not recommending that for all time. That's not for every occasion. That's for that time that they were in, where there must have been some kind of persecution. And that's definitely right. If you get family ties during persecution, then that's more opportunity to, you know, not only for you to suffer, but for family members to suffer. Because that's one of the ways they torture is through your family members. If they can't get you to crack, then they'll find weak ones in your family and use them. I think that's the main point there, is that it's better to be alone, physically speaking, if you can do it. But even then, he said, if only if you have the gift. And it does have the gift to be able to do that without sinning. Good point, Josh. All right. Ready for chapter 5? You got anything, John? Okay. All right. Well, go ahead if you get this. Okay. Okay. Chapter 5. I want to look at the first 7 verses. And then if you want to talk about something, the other part, we can do that too. Now, let's see. Brandon, you want to read verses 1 through 7 of chapter 5. I'm sorry, Brandon Tetero. Sorry, Brandon Lee. Sorry. No offense. That's okay. Yeah, that's right. That was good. We were just going from the front to the back. Sorry. I like these verses. These are very sobering thoughts here about how we need to be careful. We go to the house of God, and we need to be careful of what we say. And how true those words are. We are, when we go to the house of God, what's another way of saying keep your foot? King James says keep your foot. What did yours say, Brandon, on verse 1? Guard your steps, yeah. Walk prudently. Good. And we use that phrase today. We say, watch your step. And sometimes we literally mean that, but basically it's just the idea of be careful when you go to the house of God. So, can you contrast that with being casual when you go to the house of God, careless when you go to the house of God? not a good attitude, not a good frame of mind, is it? When you go to the house of God, be careful. Be more ready to hear than offer the sacrifice. Richard? I think so. I think it has to do with our speaking. Yep. The sacrifice of fools is, it's the one who wants to talk instead of listening to what God says. It doesn't mean we don't teach. Doesn't mean that, but it means we need to be coming there ready to hear what God says. Well, based on 1 Timothy 3:15, I would say it's the church, which is the church of the living God, the pillar and ground of the truth. So it is the assembly of the saints. And it is still true that we need to come ready to hear what God says. And that, if you think about it, a lot of churches are designed today so you don't really have to hear what God says. And that's not the way it's supposed to be. We'll play loud music for what? We're not really listening to God. We're not really listening to what He says. Or if we'd rather hear fables or stories or jokes, then we're not really listening to God. We're listening to something else. Yeah. Well, that's what I tie it into, is the what we say. Don't be rash with your mouth. Don't let your heart be hasty that or anything before God. For God's in heaven and you're on the earth, therefore let your words be few. We don't impress God, do we, with all the words we say. When we speak, we need to realize that our words are to be for the encouragement of others. They are to edify others. You know, some of you, I'm sure, have thought about the songs we sing. A lot of these songs we're singing, they're pretty serious words, aren't they? And we've got to be careful so that we don't make ourselves into liars by all day long of Jesus I am singing. All day long. See, there's so many lyrics and songs that if we stop and think about them, we really do make a step back and think about what we've been doing. And I think that's the idea that's being spoken of here. Be careful what you're saying. Make sure that you mean what you say. He talks about a multitude of words. That's how you know a fool's voice. Always talking. Always talking. If you say you're going to do something, make sure you do it. Verse 4 and 5. You make a vow, you make a promise, you carry it out. Always, go ahead, John. I get the idea that the dream is not a good thing. It's our imagination, it's our folly, you know. It comes through the multitude of business. That's good. How is verse 3? Do you have the King James or New Testament? Good point. Exactly that. Abundance of business. The dreams come from an abundance of business. Do we want to take a break, Grant? Okay, we'll take a break. Oh, it's time for supper. That's right. Yeah, boy, we can't. Shouldn't miss that. Okay, Thomas, go ahead and get yours in.
Many words.
That's what he does. That's good. I think it fits.